I'm Frank Gallagher, host of Soundman Confidential. It's showtime. Plug in. My next guest was a member of the Modern Lovers before joining Talking Heads in 1977. I met him in Zurich on Talking Heads' first European tour. On previous episodes, we've had Tina Weymouth, Chris France, David Byrne, and now to complete the quartet, on Soundman Confidential, Jerry Harrison. So 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Welcome to Soundman Confidential, a podcast exploring the relationship between the soundman, the band, and the audience in the middle, and all things live and musical. Today, my very special guest, an old colleague from the Talking Heads days, Jerry Harrison. Welcome, Jerry.
Nice to hear your voice, Frank. Delighted to be here.
It is a voice, Jerry. Definitely is a voice. Now, we do go back to our Talking Heads days from, and I arrived on the scene, I think, shortly after you did, a few months after you did.
That's right. I think we met you in Zurich.
We met in Zurich for the first time in Switzerland.
Yep.
I don't know too much about your early family life, because that's not something that ever came up when we were on the road. How did you get into, or when did you first become aware of music?
My father had played saxophone in a band when he was in college. And my mother played ragtime. My grandmother used to play ragtime piano in the 20s. So I was pretty aware of music. Also, my mother and my grandmother were really big fans of Elvis. So in the 50s. And then I started taking piano lessons in fourth grade. And I also started taking clarinet lessons a little later. My father had played sax, and so I learned to play sax as well, kind of identifying with him. But then, so in my first band in high school, I played sax, and then subsequently I played keyboards, and then later learned to play guitar.
Did you study? Did you read and write music?
Yeah, I could. You know, I can't really sight read well, but I could read music, sure. And I can write it. I can write it out pretty well. Actually, I used to sometimes when I'd done parts on our albums, like I'd sometimes write it out. Or I'd sometimes when we were trying to figure out harmony parts, I'd try and write out what everybody had done, because then I'd go like, oh, well, here's the note that we're somehow looking at. It made me, well, I guess basically because my understanding of theory is better than my ear was. I could go, here's the missing note, and here's how we make it a three-part harmony that doesn't have people landing on the same note, stuff like that. So, yeah, I never spent the time, and, I kind of stopped taking piano lessons in, I don't know, seventh or eighth grade, that I never spent enough time at it to become like a master of sight reading, to be able to just pick up all these pieces of music and be able to play them. What a gift that is. That would be so cool.
Yeah, but then you wouldn't be a rock and roller.
I'd be Rick Wakeman.
Yeah, that's true. Like Kyle Palmer. So you grew up in Milwaukee, and what was the music scene like? I suppose you must have been a teenager before you got involved in that, but what were you aware of going on in Milwaukee at that point, musically?
Well, it was a fantastic time because the idea of being in a band, there were people older than me who were doing it, and every high school, when they hosted a basketball game or a football game, would have a dance afterwards that usually the students from the other high school were invited to as well. So there was this need for a constant shuffling of band. I mean, I was on the committee for my high school to hire the bands. And You know, so with the football season, say there's, I don't know how many games there are, like 10, but like if they're half or home, there's five shows there. And then during the basketball season, which is much longer, there's probably, I don't know how many weeks that goes for, 20 weeks, something like that. So say 10 there, plus, you know, proms and spring dances and stuff like that. So that meant that I was, you know, could be hiring, you know, 10, 15 bands from around the area. But that meant that also every other school around there was having simultaneously having a dance. So there became a need to have a lot of different bands so that you weren't always reporting, repeating who was playing at the concert. And strangely, there was just a great deal of talent in my high school. The my high school band, the bass player in the second band went on to be Johnny Winter's bass player for 10 years, played with Mick Taylor and Bo Diddley and various other places. And then he also plays guitar and he sings, and he was had a weekly gig at B.B. King's in New York for 10 years or something like that or more. The guitar player in that band went on and became Leonard Cohen's guitar player for 25 years, played with Don McLean and Ian Anderson. I think it's Ian Anderson or Ian Matthews before that. He had been in a band called Jelly with another friend of mine from high school, and the singer and the actress, Amy Madigan, who was his girlfriend. They were, so there was this, it was a time of like, so sort of amazingly, you know, this high school band in a suburb of Milwaukee, three of us went on to play with, you know, records and people that everybody in the world knows. And also at that high school were, and they also played in bands, were the Zucker brothers, who made the, you know, did Airplane and then did Ghost and Naked Gun and other things. So an amazing lot of talent that was in this sort of random high school just north of Milwaukee. And, you know, there were older musicians around there. There was a band called the Legends, and they would go down to Florida and play Spring Break. And they really took it seriously. So that was the atmosphere. Then we would all, I mean, basically there was a group of us, and we were kind of the class was younger than me. The other thing that was interesting is that this broke down, your age barriers, because in general, there were enough kids that people were very much of their exactly their age, their friends were. But when you started playing music, you'd sometimes have people from the class who was older than you or younger than you, so you sort of started to have a wider group of friends. So there was this group that was called the Relaxers, and that was sort of what the musicians were and their friends, and we kind of stood for everything the opposite of being a jock. And we would, on the show, the days that we didn't have gigs, we'd go see other musicians play, kind of traveling all over Milwaukee, sometimes into pretty dangerous areas. There was one dance where there ended up being a big fight between the Italians and the Puerto Ricans where, of course I'd been drinking as well. I don't know how, a friend of mine and I, we just sort of got out within minutes of when sort of all hell broke loose. So, but you were always sort of on the hunt to see what people were doing. And then I went off to college and I didn't think that I would end up pursuing music. I didn't think that I was trained enough for that to be a career. I sold all of my instruments. And then my good friend Ernie Brooks, who ended up being my roommate and then also in the Modern Lovers with me, formed a band, and I kind of would go see them play. And I went, well, I'm as good as this. I should do this. So went and got new equipment and then played in a college band. But I didn't think that I thought it was just for fun. And it was only really when I met Jonathan Richman and I understood how unique his songwriting was and how I fit into that I kind of understood, well, you know, I don't have the kind of training that's, you know, we were just mentioning, you know, Rick Wakeman or Keith Emerson has, but this music is unique. It's different than anything else being written or performed in the world, and therefore it's totally legitimate.
It sure was different.
Yeah.
I actually did a tour with Jonathan after your time, and after I first met the Talking Heads, I had a little gap, and I before I moved to New York, I did a European tour with Jonathan. That was very interesting. He didn't want to use sound systems, and he didn't want in Hammersmith audience for, you know, 2,500 people. We had to talk him out of that one.
He wanted to be Caruso.
Yeah,
he wanted to be able to fill a room with his voice.
Yeah, and he didn't have it. He needed to eat more pasta, I think, if he wanted to be Caruso. So you went to Harvard and got involved with the Modern Lovers. And how did that come about? What was the genesis of that band? Ernie Brooks got in first and brought you in?
No, we were living together, and Jonathan wandered into our apartment. There was sort of a contingent of what was known as Andy Warhol superstars, people that were in his movies.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you've ever read the book Edie, about Edie Sedgwick. And there is Edie Sedgwick was, you know, a number of Andy Warhol movies, and there was a guy named Ed Hood who was in Bite Boy, and Rene Ricard, who's kind of well known because he's the one who sort of is kind of credited with discovering Jean-Michel Basquiat, and he was in Chelsea Girls and Mercy. So they were this contingent in Cambridge, and they kind of came over to our apartment, and Jonathan was with them, and Jonathan was raving about Loaded, which it was the latest Velvet Underground album of the time. And I was making a documentary film about alienation, and I kind of felt that Jonathan, because he was embracing the sort of imagery of advertising, and particularly older advertising. He was hated Exxon, but loved Esso, and he loved the flying horse of Mobil, and he liked the Howard Johnson symbol and things like that. So I ended up filming him talking as we were driving along Route 9 outside of Boston, near where he grew up, with him showing his favorite signs and symbolism along the highway, and then I recorded him performing. And that was going to be the musical background of the film. So we were listening. I was listening to it over and over again. And Ernie was like, "These are something about these songs." And Jonathan was kind of hanging around because I think he was a little lonely. And I think he found Ernie and I people that were simpatico for talking to. And then we ended up, both of us ended up joining simultaneously. We actually both took a semester off from Harvard, second semester of our senior year, which you can imagine really went over well with my parents. But fortunately, we were able to get in the last semester the following fall while being in the band. And for me, it actually worked out really, really well. I was doing a thesis that I was not finished with, and because I took the extra time, took the time off, I got a summa cum laude in the thesis, and would never have done that had I not had that extra time to basically work on it.
Yeah, I actually graduated from college pina colada.
I see.
So Jonathan, his sound, how did his sound evolve? Was he always anti-loud music from the get-go?
No. I mean,
texture.
To me, the first Modern Lovers record is the first punk record. Right. It's very aggressive. You know, it's very aggressive sounding and loud. And the reason I think it's kind of the first punk record is that I think of the ethos of punk as being that you may not have amazing facility on your instrument, but if you have something you want to say, you will find a way to express it with whatever instruments are available to you and with and whatever finesse you have on those instruments. And Eno used to talk about this, about that when someone starts playing guitar, they often pick much harder. And when, like, later on, they become more modulated in their picking. But there's a really difference to a string picked really hard and one picked more gently. And so a young, and in this case, we'll say punk guitar player, will often play all downstrokes, but fairly hard. And there's a brashness to the, what, because it's, you know, bending the string a little bit and seems to bring out the upper harmonics of the note than compared to when you hit, you know, have it, let's say, a little bit more modulated or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so it really changes how the sound of what one plays. It's certainly not as smooth as you become later, but it is, it's kind of noticeable. I mean, we used to take advantage of this in the Talking Heads by sometimes exchanging instruments and playing something else that we were not, had very little expertise on, so that it would have a, you know, it would have take on a different character.
Yeah. Did you play both keyboards and guitar with the Modern Lovers? Or?
By the end of the Modern Lovers, I did, because Jonathan began go into his softer mode and to reject some of the earlier, his playing. Also, he really wanted to move on to other songs. I mean, there were these twin tensions in the band that David Robinson wanted the record to be perfect. And I think Jonathan was very much, it's like you just capture the moment at this time and then you move on. And because we got signed to a pretty good deal with Warner Brothers, it was, their sense was they wanted us to make the right record that they could promote. But we sort of, I mean, this is why the Berserkly record, which is basically the demo sessions we did for Warner Brothers and A&M in 1972, became that record, even though it didn't come out till 1976, amazingly, and was kind of an inspiration to the punk movement. I remember on the tour that we were just talking about in 77, meet at that party that the Ramones had that the Sex Pistols came to after going down the Thames on their barge for the Queen's Jubilee. And Johnny Rotten had said that the only record he liked at all was the Modern Lovers. So I went up and said, that was very nice what you said about that. And he was sort of, couldn't believe that he'd been actually caught saying something was good. So he tried to back away.
It's not like him.
Well, certainly not at that time. It was particularly, part of his image was to hate everything.
Yeah. So, what are your recollections of reproducing that sound live? Did you have your own sound guy who traveled with you? And what were your earlier recollections of how the,
in the,
how
the sound, in the
Modern Lovers? Yeah, how was the sound molded?
No, we never had. I mean, we just set the PA up fixed. And we played a few big shows opening for people who probably someone in their crew or something like that mixed it. I don't recall us ever hiring anyone. Those shows were never particularly successful, us opening for other people. We were, I mean, people would throw things at us and boo and stuff like that. I mean, they were very... the only exception to that is we opened for the New York Dolls at the Mercer Art Center in New Year's Eve 1972. And that was a fantastic show. And, I mean, we went on at 2 or 3 in the morning and we were the opening act.
I know, so the days.
It was on the... it was like on an upper, like the sixth or the seventh floor of the Mercer Art Center, which was like, I was checking it out to see where the fire exits were, because it was so crowded, and that building burned down like 6 months later.
Yeah, it did.
There's that TV show, Vinyl, and they show a scene where the protagonist of Vinyl is going to see a band play, and it basically, and then the building falls down. But I think that's kind of conflating that show with the New York Dolls that we played, because it looks like the Dolls playing in that in the show. And then, of course, it did burn down, but they tried to make it more dramatic, having the building fall down.
It was a I remember that show, but not fondly. shall we say, being kind. So, how much traveling did the Modern Lovers do? Did you play away? Did you play the whole country internationally?
We never really went on a tour. We did a few shows in New York. We mainly played around New England, and then when we came out to California, we played in San Bernardino with Tower of Power and Lee Michaels. This was where everyone, you know, the entire audience is going rock and roll, rock and roll. And you can imagine when we went into, when you get out of the hospital, will you let me back into your life, that it didn't satisfy their expectation of what rock and roll was. And so we began to be showered with objects. So then we used to go up and play in this bar in Berkeley called the Long Branch. That's near Fantasy Records. It's still there. And that was fun. In fact, there's a recording from there that's on an obscure album, I think on Bomp Records or on something, I'm not sure which, that already put together.
So how long did the Modern Lovers in that incarnation last with you involved?
Well, I joined in January of 1971. And we started to sort of splinter out in California when Jonathan wouldn't really perform the older, the songs that everybody, that we'd been signed and everyone was expecting to be on the record. We worked with John Cale, but it was just Jonathan had a great deal of a admiration for. So when we worked with him in 1972, it was really, you know, it was very sympathetic. And then I guess it was a year later when we were working with him again, Jonathan had started to write songs like Hey There Little Insect, and he was just in a new place and a new style of guitar playing. It's actually what got me to play guitar, because he wouldn't play the original parts the way they were. So some of them were, I think I could play those. So actually, he gave me a guitar because he had changed what kind of guitar he wanted to play. And I pushed myself to learn guitar well enough to play the parts that he played originally so we could record that record. But anyway, then we came back and David Robinson left the group, and Jonathan and Ernie and I tried to kind of put it back together again with a drummer who had been in my high school band, who had gone off and fought in the Vietnam War, named Bob Turner. And we played a show in New York at the Townhouse Theater, I think it's called, and played around New England. But it just, Jonathan was moving, as you know, to more and more silent, and sort of being a member of the band started to seem less and less satisfying. Recently, although last year I made a record with Jonathan called SA, where I played harmonium on it, and it worked out really, really great. I'll send you a copy of it.
Oh, I'd like to hear that.
Yeah, it's pretty. It's on Blue Arrow Records. It's not on any streaming service, or it might be on Bandcamp, but it's certainly unlike any other record I heard released last year.
the Modern Lovers went away, and you were asked to get involved with Talking Heads,
right?
Who at that point didn't have a record deal,
right? I I first met them, and we did a couple of shows before they signed their deal with Sire, and then they signed their deal in the fall. I was just entering architecture school and kind of felt, just as I met them, and I kind of realized I wanted to join them, but I had already deferred going to architecture school 1 year because I did an album and a tour with Elliot Murphy. Uh-huh. And I thought that I better enroll so that I could come back to it, into this sort of, you're accepted, doesn't go on forever. And so they were I really appreciate that they kind of waited for that fall, and then I joined after that semester was over.
And would that have been 76 when you
Yes, started? That was in 76. But I kind of really understood from playing with them right in the beginning that it just worked really well. It's actually kind of a funny story, is that I was so broke really from the aftermath of the Modern Lovers that I had, the only way I could get to New York to have a rehearsal with them was to, Ernie had kept the band and I helped Ernie move a family to New York in the van, and then there was no room for the keyboard. So I ended up showing up just with a guitar, and they said, well, we were looking for a keyboard player. And I said, well, I play guitar too. Let's just have a rehearsal. And it blended. It just worked really, really well. I think that one of the things that I did that I think was different than many of the other people that they had considered was that I tried to fit into what they were doing rather than to show them everything I could play. I think other people were trying to, you might say, show their technique, and then ended up sort of stomping over what was a really delicate balance between the three of them, whereas I took the position that I just wanted to reinforce what was already there and make it fuller, and also then be able to have, you know, contrapuntal parts to David's guitar or times when we were more in unison, as well as it gave David the freedom that if he broke a string, like, that most of the music didn't go away. So I think it freed David to be able to be a little more carefree about his singing.
So did you tour much with them before, or travel much with them before you came to Europe for that?
Just around the New York area. We were playing CBGBs in Max's Kansas City, and then other shows that they could get. But we started making the album in the spring before that, and almost recorded everything on that record, on the Talking Head 77, before we went to Europe. So that was really, the concentration was rehearsals for the album and then the recording of the record. And then we did a little bit more recut Psycho Killer when we came back, because we'd done a kind of gentler version that had cello on it. The musician Arthur Russell, who's then developed quite a cult audience, particularly in England, who actually wrote songs on some of my solo records with me, was a co-writer. So anyway, after playing with the Ramones, it was just obvious that we needed to cut that song with the energy that we had on that tour. And so we did that, and that became then, the first single from 77.
Yeah, Psycho Killer had a very big impact. So on me, because going back to the Talking Heads meeting you, I'd been off the road for a couple of years doing a restaurant thing in London, and my first tour back was Ramon's Talking Heads, and Talking Heads didn't have a sound man. They didn't have any crew, actually. So
yes, I recall all of this. I remember you very astutely analyzing the situation, coming up and saying, so you don't have a mixer, I'll do the mixing. And we went, oh, that sounds good. Great. I mean, we certainly knew that we didn't want to have the Ramones. Johnny was such a competitive person that if their sound man had mixed us, he would have deliberately made us sound bad.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. There would have been sabotage.
I mean, not just out of being, out of trying to answer to what he considered his boss's desires. And I remember that Johnny was upset that I paid his brother, or Joey's brother, Mitchell. We paid him to tune our guitars.
Yeah.
And Johnny didn't like the fact that someone, that we were borrowing anyone from their crew. But of course, it was the only way to really make that tour work. So
what are your memories of, A, having a constant sound man and a constant sound system every night on the tour, which was new to you as well?
Well, one of the things that I really noticed almost right away is that in the Modern Lovers, and part of this is because we owned a PA, because we were like, that's what bands did, that sucked. But we had, that we would set up. But particularly Jonathan and me would play very differently depending on the acoustics and how well we heard each other. And we were generally playing without monitors. And so, we would play differently in a room that had echo in it compared to a dry room and things like this. Whereas Talking Heads, we really sort of defined what we were going to play. And there were the times in the song where we would stray from the parts that were written, but we made it so that we could perform the songs. I mean, I always said I can perform the song as long as I can hear the snare drum and a little bit of the vocals so I know where David is in the song, and then I can play it. I wouldn't have to hear anything else. And that made us very consistent. I mean, obviously having you as a sound man and having real sound systems also made it far more consistent. But as you know, we were very careful with our money, and we began that Tina was the road manager, and then I became the road manager. And, you and Ace were the crew.
In America, and, yeah.
I think there were times where we would help load or unload equipment we needed to hurry. We didn't want to ever get in debt to our record company, because we felt that, you can't control your destiny if you are in debt like that. And so,
yeah, we would have.
But it also meant that we never had like complicated lights until far longer.
Yeah, in fact, we had very, very minimal everything. Well, in Europe, Ian and I were the crew. And then when I moved to New York, I got Ace involved. And Ace had come from Kiss, and he worked with Dr. John. And so he was used to big productions. And I had to talk him into this, and he was appalled at how minimal the whole thing was. But he said, "What you have a 12-foot truck, 4 band and 2 guys, But I remember in Europe too that Chris telling me that you guys were on $5 a day from Sire per diem.
5 in Europe and $3 a day in England.
OMG.
Yeah. I mean, it was like, well, you're going to get food at the gig. I mean, I just remember like them bringing in sandwiches, which the European idea of a sandwich was a single piece of prosciutto and some bread.
Yep.
So you'd end up just, we were used to like the Carnegie Deli, which is like all meat. So, you take 30 sandwiches to make one.
Yeah.
I have to say that first tour is still among my fondest remembrances.
Yeah.
Of touring. The weather was just absolutely wonderful. And I don't think I've ever been to England where it was more beautiful than on that tour.
Yeah, we had it was a very special tour as well. And in those days, I was a little bit wild. to put it mildly. I was very opinionated, but did you have any? What was your standout gig on that tour, from a live perspective, and also the transition from the talk? Because I'd never heard the Talking Heads record before I mixed you. I'd heard nothing. I got no time to even, I barely knew the name of the band because there was nothing in England. I think
it was an import single,
I think, was the only thing out. And
I think that you mixed the first show, which we had a minimal sound check, and then like, okay, you're on.
Yeah, yeah.
We had just flown in from New York, and okay.
So it was.
Yeah. You had to think fast.
Not baptism by fire. But the other point is I'd been off the road for a couple of years, and so coming back and hearing this completely. Well, first the Ramones soundcheck. I was just laughing, you know. I thought, what is this? What's going on here? And then by the time we got to the Roundhouse, I knew what it was. Listening to the, shall I say, raw sound of Talking Heads coming off the stage without hearing the record, and just working like that, and then getting a texture. It was fascinating for me. It was very exciting.
I think that was it's not dissimilar to when I just jumped into being in the band, and it was it was obvious that there was something really, really wonderful and unique about. I never had any. I always knew we'd be an important band. I had no idea how commercially successful we'd be. I thought it was very possible that we just would be an artistic success, but still. Sort of develop a cult, but not necessarily a gigantic audience. We were actually commercially more successful than I had first thought we would get to.
When I first heard David shrieking and thinking, I'm going, what the fuck is this? You know, who is this guy? Can't look the audience in the eye. You know, he's looking at his feet. It's like at that point he was pretty. He wasn't fully developed on stage, shall we say.
Well, I think that one of the great things that we did is that we toured a lot. And, you know, once we got going, and particularly once Gary, who was the master of getting gigs for bands, I think the Ramones and the Talking Heads were the only two bands that came out of CBGBs that really went on the road for long, extended periods and toured. Blondie did a fair amount, but I don't think they liked it in the same way. And Television, I think of the Blondie, Television, Talking Heads, and the Ramones as sort of the first wave of really good bands to come out of CBGBs. I think Patti Smith is predating CBGBs.
Yeah.
And even though she played there. And the Television, I think, one of the things that happens to you when you go on the road is that you can be a gigantic star in your own country, and then you go to another place and suddenly you're playing clubs instead of theaters, you know, and you have to build the audience again. And, you know, not every band either likes being on the road that much, or they don't like the fact that they're going on tour and they don't make any money.
We had some great opening acts. We had U2, we had XTC, we had Dire Straits.
Yep.
Transitioning now to the I got a call saying there's a rehearsal at Brit Row. Go down there. And so Binky was there and Jeff Shaw was there. There were some other roadies and some Brit Row people. And I had up to that point, I had no knowledge that there was going to be a 9-piece. It was just like, bang, just let's get the gear and get a couple of people. So I walk in and there's Bernie Worrell and Buster Jones and Steve Scales, Nona Hendricks, Adrian Ballou. And Adrian I had met, but nobody else. And then putting this together, this texture together, because you just started playing. It wasn't really a sound check. You just started playing and I picked up a mix.
I began those rehearsals teaching everyone in that. I mean, I had been hanging around with Buster Jones and had met Dolette and Bernie through, and I knew Adrian. So I went and hired that band one afternoon when we were at Sigma Sound. And then David had gone to, while we were finishing mixing the record, David went out to L.A. because we were running out of time and mixed a few songs with Dave Churden out there. And I stayed with Eno and John Patoker at Sigma Sound. But also during the afternoons, I would go out and started teaching everybody in the new band, you know, the parts of the songs. And David showed up after a few days of rehearsals. I can't remember if you were you there right at the beginning when we were doing that without David?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so anyway, yeah, I mean, we thought we might only do that for two shows up in Toronto and Central Park. But of course, it was just so wonderful. We had to keep going.
That was amazing. You know, the Central Park show was amazing. But that texture, getting that texture with two bass players, a keyboard player, percussion, it was a busy mix for me, but I don't remember it as being that hard work because of what was coming off the stage. You know, what people were getting.
Well, I think there was, the one thing I noticed is that because there were two bass players, and because we set up sort of like King Sunny-Ade in a long line on stage, is that stage left and stage right didn't always hear the other side of the stage that well. And so there were times when there was musical exploration going on where I was on the right side of the stage, which is where Busta was and Bernie was. And Adrian and David was in the middle, but Tina and Dave, Steve Scales, Tina and Adrian were over on the left side. And so there were times where I felt like it was like Charles Ives, like sort of related, but sort of abstractly going off in two different directions at once. And that was some pretty, I wish we had recordings of every show of that tour.
Yeah. So there was some magic went on there.
Yeah. I mean, the one that was captured in that YouTube video that you can find from Rome is a pretty amazing example.
That was a wild day out, that whole day. You know.
Yep. I think that was the day that we found out that John Lennon had been murdered.
We were in Lyon. We were in Lyon when that happened. I remember distinctly.
Yeah, but then wasn't it the same time that we had, because again, Italy was on strike, that we had to take a bus all night long?
Yeah, we had to get.
Because we couldn't fly to Rome?
Yeah, we drove, I'm trying to remember what that bus trip was. Yeah, we had a long bus trip because we couldn't fly. In a seater bus, not in a.
That's right, that's right.
No bunks.
But I was also, I was a fan of the architect of that arena, Nervi. And so I was like, you know, I had like looked the structural, it was like a very cutting edge structure.
Was that the arena in Rome?
Yeah. Uh-huh. The span of the roof was really large.
It sounded like shit in there in an empty room. It was, there were more reverberations there it was wild. But I also, after Talking Heads, I actually did a bit of a tour with you with the Casual Gods, and I you were coming to Europe, but I couldn't come because my mother died when we played Boston. I got the news that my mother had passed away, so I had to drive home and fly back to Scotland immediately, and I missed the European part of the Casual Gusto. That was a heavy band.
The band was amazing.
It was an amazing, amazing, and a great record, great songs.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. First of all, you know, just the idea of some, you know, Chris Spedding is such a unique guitar player. Alex Weir, to me, is still the lightest touch and on the sort of rhythm guitar of anyone, including like Nile Rodgers and anyone who played with James Brown. There's something just so special about his style. And, you know, it was very challenging for me because being the lead singer is like, I just wasn't used to the pressure of it. and trying to both be playing and singing at the same time. And also I was having to, you know, because it was my, that when they did interviews, you know, they would, when Talking Heads did interviews, they would talk to all of us. So we sometimes would divide up the interviews. But on that tour, I had to do every one of them. And so it was like, you know, I was like, wow, I could lose my voice. I've got to go to bed. I can't go out and go to this party. Whereas on a Talking Heads tour, it's like, of course I'll go to the party. So it's sort of like, kind of, a, you know, you kind of go, well, there's an upside, but there's also a downside to being the lead singer.
Yeah, it's a lot more work. And Talking Heads, we were invited. We had entree to some really incredible places that the normal rock and roll band didn't get to. Our fans, yeah. Our fans were a different breed, you know.
Well, I always felt, and I think that you particularly saw this on that first tour, is that we would so often, after we finished our set, we'd kind of wander out to watch the Ramones, and we would end up meeting some very ardent Talking Heads fans, usually at the very back of the room, and they would very often invite us to go out. I mean, that's how we met, I think, Marie Le Garçon, who ended up eventually playing with us and in Lyon. And they were, it was just... we had kind of a feeling back then is that if someone were a fan of Talking Heads, well, then you probably would like to hang out with them. And yeah. So there was, unlike, you know, people are going like, oh my God, I got to get away from my audience. They just want to eat me, or they want to, you know, it's just too overwhelming, or they drive me crazy. It was more like, no, these people are all really cool. I want to go over and see what books are in their library and things like that. So, you know, I mean, an example of that is you were there is when we played UCLA and all of those kind of big football players were being really aggressive as bouncers. And David kind of called them out on it. They said, okay, we'll leave. They can just smash your equipment. But of course, nobody did. It was like, you know.
Yeah.
They were, we had an audience that was excited, but they were, I don't know, they had consciousness, or they had they were both conscientious and they had consciousness. They were,
cerebral.
You know, and that was, which was sort of unlike the sort of stereotype that you would have about punk audiences, that they were, you know, what became the mosh pit, you know, or the insane amount of spitting at the audience. I mean, at the bands and things like that. That was a rather repulsive development in music. I felt
it was horrible.
You know, the audiences were already there was a Ramones audience and there was a Talking Heads audience. But on that first tour of England, it was like they had read about these in fanzines, and the Ramones had a record out, so people did know them. But there was a complete sense of like, well, we just want to see what's going on in New York. So they were really open to, you know, to having the Ramones and the Talking Heads really, really very dissimilar in sound. But to them, it was like, this is, you know, this is this whole new thing. And of course, it was this reaction to how, I don't know, I guess mannerist, I would call it, that music had become with things like Emerson, Lake and Palmer, and Yes, where it was just, I mean, sort of prog rock, this sort of this, sort of taking on the trappings of opera, of, you know, like the production just became enormous, and it was all about, you know, I mean, sort of has gone on, how many semi-trailers can you possibly fill, and, you know, what's, all this stuff that really doesn't matter. I mean, if the music isn't good, who cares about any of that stuff?
Yeah, so. Well, we had the opposite. We had nothing. It was brilliant. And people thought that the white light thing was very arty. It was not. It was arty, but it was also cheap because we didn't have a lighting
guy.
We didn't have a lighting guy, and we didn't have anyone to do bump and grind and flash on the one and, you know, flash on the two and four. And I didn't use reverbs and delays extensively, only when required, not on every song.
Yeah.
You know, I still do.
The other thing is that all the white lights on is that it meant that you could see everybody in the band all the time. And so everyone was really aware of the interplay and how we were really closely watching each other. And that, and that also, you know, every member of the band, certainly Tina in particular, had her fans. Everyone sort of had people that gravitated towards them a bit. And, but everyone knew everybody else because you were always in the light. And I mean, you know, as great as I think that something like Stop Making Sense was, there were times when I was sort of playing in the dark. And, you know, you get kind of, it was fine because I understood why it worked, because you wanted to be able to see the projection on, that was behind us or something like that. But it also, it was like you kind of get lazy. It's like, well, I'm up here doing my job, but I'm in the dark. So, Bernie, what are you doing? What are you doing after the show? You know, and so anyway, yeah, I thought that that, you know, those early years were really, and finally that show at La Coupole, where I mean, not La Coupole, at the La Palace in France with the B-52s, is still the, one of the most memorable shows.
Yeah,
I have.
That was fabulous. When the B-52s went on stage, I went in the dressing room and stole their champagne that night. More than once.
I see.
And I end up working for them at the moment. Well, we're in the COVID at the moment. I'm going to timestamp this interview. We're in COVID at the moment. And who knows when we'll play live again. Thank God we had what we had, because we had the best. We had the best of times, without question.
We sure did.
All right, Jerry, I appreciate your time in it and your conversations.
I enjoyed it.
All right, Frank, bye-bye. I'll be in touch.
All the best to you.
Aye.
All right, bye-bye.
Ta-ra. Thanks very much for plugging in. We can't do it without you. And don't forget to check out our website, soundmanconfidential.com. For news and my upcoming shows and all the fabulous guests you're going to have the pleasure of listening to. Catch you next time. Soundman Confidential is produced by Alan Black with our team, Chip Bentley on sound production, web design Addy Bell, original music Paul Westwater, and public relations Paddy DeVries at Devious Planet Media.